Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by MeterViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I have invited on the program author Alan Rolnick, and we are going to be talking about his new novel called Landmark Status. Alan grew up in Newburgh, New York, a sleepy river city on the west bank of the Hudson, where he played baseball, read science fiction, learned every Beatles song, and dreamed of living where the action is. After graduating from Johns Hopkins in 1972, he moved to New York to become a rock star and supported himself as a journalist, which eventually led to working at the New York Times. Alan eventually shifted gears in 1984, went to law school at the University of Miami, where he served as managing editor of the Law Review. In the years since, he has practiced class action and commercial litigation at top Miami law firms, and has appeared in numerous high-profile cases. Alan lives in Miami and Los Angeles today with his wife, Sharon Lane, a film producer, talent manager, as well as their son, Max. So I'm happy to have Alan on the phone today. We're going to get in on this new novel of his, Landmark Status, and find out more of what's going on in his life. So welcome to Inside Scoop Live, Alan.
Thank you, Juanita. It's great to be here.
Great, great. So, you know, I know you've been a writer for so many years, but your new novel, Landmark Status, really is your first published book. So how is it? How are you feeling seeing your first novel in print on the shelves today?
Well, I'm very excited.
Yeah.
And I must admit, grateful to your reviewers at ReaderViews and to some other reviewers who've decided they like the thing. Very exciting. I've been pinching myself ever since I started getting the reviews, and it's starting to hurt.
You really are getting great, great reviews for a first-time novel, so really congratulations on that. And tell us a little bit about the progression of your writing over the years and how it eventually evolved into the realm of a novel. And really, on a side note, what took you so long?
Without being too repetitive, I guess I've always been writing something.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been interested in trying to write something. When I was younger, I couldn't type very well. That didn't help. And even though I've always been writing for a living or for fun or to try and make art, from the time I started writing a column in my high school paper, I guess I've been interested in all sorts of different things, and I was, to be perfectly honest, somewhat intimidated by the form of the novel.
Mm.
I mean, that's a lot of pages.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, I'm still surprised when I look on the computer at the word count for Landmark Status. I don't remember what it is, but I think it's over 100,000 or something like that.
And that all came from you.
Yeah, and
amazing.
I'm not going to say that I'm one of those cats who just locks himself in the room and, you know, emerges 2 weeks later with a beer to the floor and a book. Because
mm-hmm.
I learned that it didn't have to be that way. But I was sure enough intimidated for a long time that the guys whose books I read, who I admired, must have been from some other planet than the rest of us.
How long did this one take you to write?
I toted it up, and it's been about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems longer.
Mm-hmm.
From the first outline to publication, it was about 5 years.
That's a long time. So you talk about some of your writing influences, some of the books that you've read that have really moved you. Who were these authors?
Well, to be honest, I've read an awful lot of different genres of literature and picked up, I don't know, a fairly encyclopedic experience of pop culture because I've been around so long.
Mm-hmm.
I was there at an early age for everything from Chuck Berry to Bill Haley to Little Richard to you fill in the blank with your father or mother of rock and roll, right through to the present and trying to find bands that I like in every era, which, by the way, is not an easy thing, where the radio is lousy, always was kind of non-groundbreaking, if you will. For example, in the book, there is a running joke that I hope works. One of my editors flagged it a couple of times and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, no, that's a running joke. You don't get it.
Oh, really?
The radio in Miami, it's not good. They play the same thing over and over again. That's what I'm getting at here.
Oh.
Is it not working for you? And the editor said, well, I'm not really getting that.
That's kind of radio everywhere these days, it seems.
Well, you know, when I'm in L.A., it's a little bit different.
I bet, yeah.
And that's exciting because there are some stations out here, some public stations. I found some Internet stations. I'll give a shameless plug to KCRW, kcrw.com. There's also an Internet-only progressive rock station called RadioParadise.com from up in Eureka someplace where, you know, I'll hear stuff that I like. Just here's tangent number one. Over the weekend, I was listening to KCRW, and they played a couple of tracks that I'd never heard before. One of them turned out to be an instrumental from an Eastern European jazz group called Noah, and it was a big club song last year called Balkan Hot Step. The other one was...
Far out there, Alan.
The other one was chase music from a Bollywood movie from 1979.
Oh, my God.
And I knew when I heard those two tracks that I had finally found the chase music for Raj's two action scenes. His two for real scenes with Raj. And for those who've read the book, Raj is an Indian-Jamaican guy who was an investment banker in Boca Raton and is now retired into the import-export business with a cigar shop on Flagler Street in downtown Miami. But Raj, to some extent, ends up being an action hero in this book, and action heroes need theme music, and there's some chase scenes. And I've now found, as soon as somebody hands me the $5 or $10 million we need to make this picture, I've got a lot of the music cues worked out. And a lot of them are written into the book, but these are a couple that weren't. I love the music that I hear when I'm in L.A. Miami is a little trickier.
It's a little different. I didn't know that the music influenced you and your writing as much as it did.
You know, in a way, I guess it's an odd thing because I have been sort of a vacuum cleaner for pop culture all my life, and a lot of the references in the book are just kind of laid in there for people to pick up.
Yeah.
There's even some in the interviews that we've done where there may be a fragment of a song lyric, and if somebody knows it, they may get it. And, you know, I always appreciated that kind of stuff in the records when I was a kid. You know, we'd be listening with headphones for, you know, the hit "Paul is Dead" if you play it backwards, you know, but I never heard that. But sometimes there would be stuff that was laid in between the lines, so to speak.
Obviously, you are a very, very witty guy, you know, and this really also comes across in your writing, and there's quite a bit of satire as well, and I know that this is something that characteristically is a part of your writing. So where did this come from?
You know, it might be sort of a genetic thing.
Really?
Because I don't really know. In my best moments, hopefully people would liken me to an old Yiddish spritzer kind of guy who just gets up there and starts declaiming and doing his own thing, which is one of the reasons why I feel comfortable doing old Jewish guys as characters. There isn't too much of that in Landmark Status. Benji, our hero, Benji Bluestone, the trust fund baby lawyer, is the son of such a guy, Bernard. Bernard's mostly off stage. We only really hear him on the phone a few times and get to meet him at the end of the book. I've had, in the book I'm working on, the new book, I've had more opportunity to explore Bernard. And it's kind of fun because Bernard and Benji are at once younger and older than I am chronologically, but it gives me a chance to spread around my own experiences and put some into each one's head. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, and I'm completely off the subject, so feel free to tase me if it's necessary. It wasn't until I got to about page 100 of the new manuscript that I ever put Benji and Bernard in the same room together.
Oh, that's interesting.
It was fascinating. I got to tell you, Juanita, it was like being at a family holiday.
Yeah.
Like celebrating Hanukkah. It was real nachas. I mean, there they were. They were in the room. They put the arm around each other. They're wisecracking with each other. And the wisecracking is important.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because I now realize it's so much a part of what I prize in life, and the people whose company I enjoy do it too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure, you know, this is not unique. People all over do this. I've been in a few different law firms, and virtually every law firm that I've ever been in, either as a visitor or as, you know, one of the denizens of the halls of the place itself on a full-time basis, I was in the company of other guys who would sit around making wisecracks all day.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot tell you how many times I've been around lawyers for whom quoting the Godfather dialogue is just something that you do. You're supposed to know the dialogue from the Godfather. So, to be fair, I've got a lot of... It's not like I never read a book. I wouldn't want people to think that. When I was in the fourth grade, I read every book in the fourth grade section of my grade school library.
Mm-hmm.
And I have read Mark Twain, and I am a great admirer of Kurt Vonnegut. May he rest in peace. Mm-hmm. Other folks who might be regarded as somewhat irascible social commentators... I went to college in Baltimore and became a fan of H.L. Mencken. How can you not become a fan of H.L. Mencken?
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, I guess I've swept up a whole lot of pop culture references over the years and decades, and my writing is littered with it.
Yes, it is. It really is. Well, so let's talk about the novel a little bit. Tell us, or tell your listeners, what the story is in Landmark Status.
Okay. As the title suggests, there is a building, and it is possibly going to be designated as a historic building and granted Landmark Status. The building is called the Century Club. It's an old watering hole that was famous in the 40s and the 50s and has been swooning in subtropical decay by Biscayne Bay for the last 30, 40 years, which is not uncommon in a place like Miami,
mm-hmm.
where this is not to say that Miami is the only place where stuff like this happens, but Miami is kind of interesting because of its youthfulness. The city itself is really only 100 years old.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you can find parts of Dade County that were actually incorporated earlier. Is that my cell phone making those beeps? Hold on, let me shut this thing off. But for the most part, it's a young frontier city.
Mm-hmm.
And the climate doesn't cooperate very much. It's hard for buildings to have an extended useful life.
Oh.
And you see this all the time. I mean, there was a big hue and cry to get a basketball team in 1986, I guess. The Miami Heat moved into a building that was built for them downtown. That was essentially replaced within 20 years by a bigger, spiffier, fancier building a few blocks east.
Mm-hmm.
Not totally because it had outlived its useful life, but you do find turnover caused as much by the climate as the fickleness of consumers and the transience of matters of taste. But our club, the Century Club, is a place that a lot of people forgot, but it's still sitting there. When a local building boom takes off and a convention center comes off the drawing board that's near enough to make the property valuable, the usual suspects, as well as some of the unusual suspects, decide that they've got to get their hands on it.
Mm-hmm.
But when they send the beautiful and brilliant Delia Torres to make her offer on the property, owner Walter Marsh says, "Hey, I already optioned this property." She says, "To whom?" He says, "To some guys out of Houston called Mastodon Partners. You know who they are?"
No.
She says, "Oh, yeah, I know them."
Oh.
And apparently everybody in Miami knows those guys because they are They're a partnership affiliated with the Mammoth Development Company out of Houston, which is owned and run by its patriarch, an eccentric paleontologist named, Woolly Johnson.
And so is this a real organization in Houston, or is this made up?
Oh, heck no. None of these people are real.
Okay, I was wondering how much reality is in your novel.
Well, there's a lot of reality. But hopefully no reality I could get sued about.
Okay.
I was very careful
smart.
to try and make that distinction clear.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I tried to blend reality and unreality, the made-up stuff. I mean, the Century Club is itself situated in a fictitious Dade County mini-city. Dade County, apart from having the city of Miami in it, has a lot of other littler cities, and the process of incorporation is one that creates many cities all the time. And I made one up for the book called Bayview.
Oh, okay.
The mayor and padron of Bayview is Delia's Uncle Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
And Uncle Oscar is the guy who is driving the train when it comes to trying to undermine Walter's deal with Mastodon Partners. The problem is that Walter's sold Mastodon Partners an option. He's run out of money. He spent it all. The option's going to expire in 2 weeks, and they're not calling anymore. At which point, Delia shows up with the offer that Oscar and his cronies are presenting, reports back that the property's under option, and Oscar's got to come up with a plan. He needs to make that option, to quote Willie Johnson, something so ugly the tide won't take it out, so that they don't exercise it, and that Oscar and his pals can get their hands on the property on the cheap.
Okay.
And there goes the thought process that leads them to file an emergency action to enjoin the sale of the property and any development on the site, because it's historic.
Okay, right.
And that's what gets the ball rolling here.
Okay. And so how does Benji Bluestone fit into all of this?
Well, Benji happened to have been Walter's lawyer.
Second or third divorce?
Walter's been married 3 times. I think that Benji represented him in the third divorce. And unlike the first two wives, the third wife was not a stripper. Walter has a soft spot for exotic dancers. And I don't know, maybe it's just because Miami novels end up doing that. There's a couple of...
Is that trademark?
I don't know. I mean, in a way, maybe this is a semi-conscious homage to Carl Hyacin, who set a whole story in a strip joint. In any event, Walter gets these papers dropped on his desk the day after he tells Delia the property's been optioned, and calls his lawyer. Says, Benji, I need help. There's an emergency hearing this afternoon. They're trying to enjoin my sale. And Benji says, what are you talking about? Because he hasn't heard from him in a long, long time. Walter unburdens himself and talks about this deal that he's made. Benji scolds him, does everything he can to get out of doing this, because if there's one thing Benji doesn't want to do, it's walk in his father Bernard's long shadow.
Oh, okay.
Because Bernard is Miami's legendary land use lawyer and deal maker. And he and his law firm have had a hand in just about every important project that blighted the skyline for the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Benji's tried to go his own way. He actually fancies himself an elder care lawyer, the common thread in all of his legal practice being that he represents older people. Of course, at one point in their conversation early in this book, Walter says, all right, so I'm old now. How old do I have to be? Represent me. I need help. Your name is Bluestone. You got to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And people are always telling Benji that. Your name's Bluestone. Why don't you do this? And he doesn't really have any good answer for it. But he knows he's stuck. Walter's got nowhere else to turn. So Benji says, all right, I'll do it. And all of a sudden he's involved in this emergency litigation, getting ready to traipse down to the courthouse and make his argument.
So, with so many directions that a novel set in Miami could go, why did you decide to really focus on the real estate, land development, political theme in this novel?
I'm still trying to figure that out.
Well, I know it's a big, big hot topic down there in Miami and southern Florida. I mean, the land development is just off the chart.
Well, to to try and give this a useful answer, I think what happened was I spent a number of years around lawyers and as a lawyer concerned with deals that were either going up, going into effect, breaking down, or in litigation involving real property.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to the conclusion that the major business in South Florida, no matter what other businesses are thrown off by its climate, location, move there, the major business is the sale and resale of the same dirt to the next wave of newcomers, usually in smaller slices, somewhat in sometimes in vertical slices instead of horizontal pieces when it becomes too expensive. But I started looking into that, and I realized that it would be easy to characterize South Florida as a place where that really is the primary business. And I didn't invent this idea. There were some academicians who suggested that this was something like a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
Because it's not a renewable, expandable resource. You're not making product here. You're basically cutting smaller slices of the same pie. And unless it keeps going up in value and you keep finding new buyers, the business will collapse.
Just stalls out. Mm-hmm.
And coincidentally, I, as a litigator, had been involved in a number of cases relating to and arising from Ponzi schemes, which are very, very common in South Florida.
Where did this whole term Ponzi scheme come from? And is this illegal? Is it legal to kind of manufacture a Ponzi scheme?
Typically, it's to break that down, the notion of the Ponzi scheme has been around for a long time. It's not really new.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Ponzi made it incredibly famous with his postal stamp scam in the 1920s, and that's when his name became associated with it. But it really is just the sale of investment interests in a company that pays real high returns, usually on a short-term basis, that is funded from the investment money of the later investors. So the new guy pays his money, starts getting high interest returns because the promoter's out there selling more investment, and the later investors are the ones whose money is being used to pay the earlier investors' returns. He tells his friends, he tells his family, word of mouth spreads, and the next thing you know, everybody is running to the promoter and asking if they can get in on this fantastic investment.
Wants a piece, right.
The illusion of a real business is necessary, but most of the time that illusory business really isn't doing anything at all. This is a violation. To sell this kind of investment is obviously fraud.
Right.
Because you're telling people that they're investing in something that they really aren't. And as a consequence, it violates all kinds of laws, including the securities laws, state and federal securities laws, as well as the common law of fraud, because that's what this amounts to. And I guess I may as well give away the fact that the great Florida Ponzi scheme, as I sometimes refer to it, and as I think the article I once read, and I can't cite it right now, referred to it, the sale and resale of the same dirt over and over again, is bracketed and accompanied by another Ponzi scheme going on in landmark status that's sort of in the background for most of the book. And actually, I'll drop this secret. It actually resembled one that I litigated a number of years ago. I've seen Ponzi schemes involving the arbitrage of grocery discounts, the homemade bracelet market and necklace market, if you will.
That
one was particularly egregious because they were preying on poor people.
Oh, gosh.
To buy these kits of beads and strings and make a fortune reselling them somewhere, I don't know where.
Mm-hmm.
But It seldom happens that 6 months pass without a new Ponzi scheme being reported on in South Florida.
Is that right? What do you think it is about that area, or is that everywhere?
Well, the one thing I don't want to do is overrate the uniqueness of the place, because I know this happens in all sorts of other places. But I think people bring money to South Florida for safekeeping from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
sometimes in violation of currency restrictions in their home countries.
Okay.
But whether that's true or not, the money is brought with them to South Florida for safekeeping. As soon as they get here, they find out that there's people on every street corner with a scheme to part them from that money.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
After successfully completing the challenging process of publishing a book, many authors find themselves arriving at a new and even more challenging step in their writing career, and that is attracting an audience and gaining publicity for their newly published work. ReaderViews.com offers valuable resources for this important step in an author's career, and they now provide the latest marketing tool, the book preview. These are videos created to promote books in the same way that movie trailers promote movies, and they are amazing. Go to ReaderViews.com today to find out more about previews. Just click on the previews icon in the menu bar for more information.
And now back to Inside Scoop Live with your host, Juanita Watson.
People have suggested, people far brighter than I have suggested that, you know, it's sort of like things that flow downstream. Miami's kind of at the southernmost end of the mainland. You can't go much farther. And if you're on the run or if you're just kind of dripping to the place of least resistance, you're going to end up there.
That's where you pool.
It's a place that attracts criminals because just like it's a place that attracts honest people. The climate is relatively benign.
Yes.
If you can get used to the heat. You know, if I had to live under a bridge, which is something that I'm always afraid I'm going to be doing, that's the place I'd rather be doing.
Yeah, right. Sure. How long have you been in Miami?
I moved to Miami in 1984.
Okay. So a while.
Long enough to call myself a native.
Okay. So what happens in an area such as southern Florida and other areas in the country that this kind of development is happening? What happens to the infrastructure of a city as well as the mindset of the people when they see these developments springing up? And, you know, I think that probably buildings sit there and there's a lot of confusion and, you know, the politics involved and the criminality involved. What happens to people observing this that's happening in their city?
Well, I think there's a whole panoply of reactions. It probably depends on, you know, where you're coming from. For example, Walter Marsh, the owner of the Century Club, has grown up in the place, remembers the jazz greats playing there and the famous gangsters hanging around, and you know, everybody from Eddie Arcaro to Ava Gardner to some people I made up,
mm-hmm.
like the Fine Brothers, Mo and Izzy, Miami's most famous card sharks. But he, for example, it's easy to see, is from an old Southern family that came to Miami quite a while ago, 60, 70 years ago, and he's watched the place transform around him from sort of a sleepy southern outpost to this capital of the Caribbean in South America, this multicultural oasis for people from all over the world. Walter has a habit of complaining about the music that people listen to these days, including his bartender, and he prefers, you know, classic rock.
Mm-hmm.
His needle is stuck somewhere in the 70s, and Miami's morphing into something he barely recognizes.
Yeah.
So, you know, he feels, I think, somewhat dislocated and hard done by as a lot of English-speaking Anglos, if you will, in South Florida have felt over the last 20, 30 years.
Mm.
And as a side note on this Anglo business, I get a real kick out of this because I grew up in New York State in a small river city that had a pretty diverse ethnic mix.
Yes.
There were old white families with money that lived on the river. There were immigrant communities, Irish, Italian, Jewish, from the turn of the last century. There was an African-American community, a growing Latino community. But, you know, the Jews were not that numerous. I never lived in a place with a lot of Jews until I lived in New York City and then eventually moved to South Florida. But it never occurred to me that I would ever live in any place where they would call me an Anglo. That was amazing.
Mm.
Where I grew up, no, I knew who the Anglos were. They were the guys, named Pierce Killeen. I don't even know what all their names were. I don't remember now. But
mm-hmm.
They lived down by the river someplace.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, I'm in South Florida, and because of the fact that I'm white and I don't speak Spanish, they I'm an Anglo. I mean, that was great, you know, because I was passing. It's like really passing.
Mm-hmm.
They were taking me for a WASP. I went through the whole college experience. You know, I met kids who went to Andover and Exeter, and it was like I was either they or I was from Mars. I didn't know which was which, but this was exciting to be in this place where, you know, I would go into the store and they would look at me and they would be like, oh no, can't talk to Spanish, this guy. But in any event, I don't want to make too much of that because the labels that people stick on each other are part of the problem.
Sure.
If anything, if this book is useful for anything beyond some laughs, it might be to raise questions about the labels that we stick on each other.
That's a great point, because I think that there are quite a few deeper messages. You know, this is a great, entertaining read, but, you know, you did, because of the nature of your writing, you know, you do add the social commentary aspect to it. So I think that really does come out. And I was actually wanting to know if those were conscious, you know, in the writing process, if you really did want to throw those conscious messages out there.
Thanks again for the compliments.
Sure.
I still really don't know how to field them, but I'm going to. It's clear that to me that I did want to do more than just yuck it up, and you know it's a great thrill to hear people say, to hear you say right now that it's a great read, because who knows? I mean, I've worked with people who were comics. I've worked with people who were comic writers, and I never thought of myself as either. I was, you know, as far as lawyers go, I was pretty funny. But then again, we're talking about lawyers here.
You're a funny guy. Come on, you know.
I don't know. But the wonderful thing here is that I was cautious about the waters I was getting in, because there's been a lot of oars in these waters from a lot of people more qualified and smarter than me, trying to figure out what's going on here. South Florida and Miami in particular is a place where you see the American experience happening almost like it's been accelerated in a chemistry experiment that's been accelerated with some kind of reagent. Because, as I said, the city's kind of young. The people have been getting there in short time frame. The habitable space is not that big.
Yeah, that's true.
And that geographic limitation is part of what makes the place what it is in every aspect that we've just been discussing. Because everybody's thrown into close proximity. If you drive 25 miles from the beach, you're in the Everglades. Period. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the city council and the county commission may be arguing about, you know, whether or not to violate the master plan and put a big box store out there.
Gosh.
And in fact, you know, I'm repeating something that actually happened last week, and you know, it happens all the time. I mean, that's the way they do it. They keep trying to push the development out further. The problem, of course, and this gets back to something you suggested before, is that the infrastructure is always trailing construction. And it's never going to catch up, because one of the things that makes Florida attractive to people is the fact that there's no income tax.
Oh.
There being no income tax is a tough state of affairs when you're talking about infrastructure. It's not a place that is really wonderful for educating children, because the public schools don't have enough money. They don't have enough facilities. They're always running behind. Same thing with the roads. There's a lot of I mean, it doesn't take long in landmark status to find Benji complaining about the roads and the infrastructure as he's driving onto 836, headed west to the funeral of County Commissioner Eusebio Cruz, and passes by the Orange Bowl, which sadly is now probably going to be demolished within, I don't know, the next year or so.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and Benji's beloved Hurricanes are going to be playing their games up at Joe Robbie Stadium, where the Dolphin Orange Bowl will be gone.
Hmm.
It's not a surprise because the money are just never really there for public works. And people I know feel that burden everywhere.
But in places like Miami, it really does get magnified. And you know, this is really conveyed through this novel. So, you know, that's, I don't know, that's a very interesting part about this story. You know, kind of on a side note here, I really wanted to mention, I'm looking at the clock and our time is ticking down, so I really wanted to get a few more things in before we close today. And, you know, I want to kind of touch back on this whole idea of seeing landmark status possibly on the big screen someday, because, you know, your movie influence, the entertainment factor is so high for this, and I know as well that your wife is a TV or actually a film producer. So is she trying to coerce you into the, I don't know, into getting this up on the screen or getting a screenplay written?
That's funny. You don't need to tiptoe around this. No, it's funny. My wife, Sharon Lane, who I sometimes call Hurricane Sharon, is a force of nature. Sharon is a talent manager and a film producer, and she produced a film called Canvas, which can be investigated at canvasthefilm.com.
That movie actually has gotten incredible reviews, and also I think has won a number of awards, film festival awards.
Thank you. It has done well at the festivals, most recently in Rome, winning something called the Alice Award at Rome. And the film has been out in the theaters. It opened last month. The DVD is supposed to come out on January 29th. It's a film, a serious film, family drama, dealing with a family's struggle cope with mom's schizophrenia, starring Joe Pantoliano, Marcia Gay Harden,
that's
and,
right.
A very talented boy named Devin Gearhart. Sharon and I, you know, it's funny, we don't have that similar taste in most things.
Mm-hmm.
She'd probably be the first to tell you that she thinks that my writing is sort of over the top. It reminds her of Monty Python. I don't get that myself. I really don't, but certainly I have watched just about every Python episode at least 10 times over the years. But we did agree, and we occasionally do agree on something that's good, whether it's a silly comedy, more my cup of tea, or a family drama, more hers. And we did agree on Canvas years ago, and set out to try and make that film. Sharon made it,
mm-hmm.
And it's out there. And to circle back to Landmark Status, when I first outlined the story, Sharon said, why don't you write a screenplay? And I said, I don't know how to write a screenplay. She said, well, you don't know how to write a novel either, so what difference does it make?
Oh, no.
But I said, you know, I think I have a better understanding of how to do a novel. There's all this technical stuff in the screenplay writing that I'm completely unfamiliar with.
Mm-hmm.
And even after I get the screenplay done, what are we going to do then? Take another 5-10 years to make the thing? And so I decided that I wanted to write something that would be complete, wouldn't need somebody else to write a check,
mm-hmm.
before I could give it to somebody else to experience it, whether they liked it or hated it. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, the plus, which the form of the novel was something that I was more familiar with, even in an intuitive way, if you will. And so we've thought about it now. There is interest out there. Grateful for that. The good reviews and the publicity we've been getting has sparked some interest. And
mm-hmm.
I think we're going to get there. I have to be patient, and and I'm not a very patient guy, but you know, the prospects are good for making a picture here. As
well,
I suggested in our interview, in the written interview, we're not going to be able to make this one on the cheap because there's a lot of stuff. I think there's 7 car crashes. I don't know how.
Oh, I know. Your budget would have to be so big to make this, but I think it would translate so well onto the big screen, definitely. And, you know, you two are obviously such a creative duo that it would be really interesting to see what, you know, you two working together on a project like this, which would be a big budget and it would be very visual. It would be interesting to see what you would come up with. I think it would be fantastic.
Well, I appreciate the encouragement.
Yeah.
You know, because maybe it's dangerous to encourage people, you know, but in this case, I've seen this thing as a picture from the day I first sat down to write, and I guess I tend to write visually, although I try and keep the embroidery to a minimum and keep the characters moving, because I think that's best for me. I've talked a lot in interviews, including the written one that we did, about writerly writers who I admire, but who I realized I could not be at an early. And this kind of leaner, more athletic style of writing is something that I can do. And I'm just grateful that it's working. Because when I set out to write this thing, I was thinking more Hawaii 5-0 than
okay.
Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
But as I got into it, and I realized that to do it justice, I would have to kind of tell the story of Miami as well as the story of the people who were running around in my book.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it was the same story over and over again, the same cycle, on, if you will, circles within circles, larger and smaller. The story of the Biltmore Hotel or the story of Opa-locka is the same as the story of the Century Club. And I didn't really expect to be telling the story of the Biltmore Hotel or the city of Coral Gables. But it just seemed like it wasn't fair to tell the story of the Century Club and how people might be angling for control over this piece of property without explaining that it's always been this way in South Florida, and that these people are running around and colliding into each other in these historic settings that came about as a result of exactly the same thing that they're doing in the book.
Yes, yeah. So what's your website, Alan? And can your book be purchased through your website?
It can. The website is disguised as alanrolnick.com.
Okay.
And one of these days, I haven't figured out how to do it yet, but there's a bunch of other domain names that are all going to link to it.
Okay.
They're not working yet, but alanrolnick.com has reviews, excerpts, links to interviews and reviews, and a link to the purchase page at Amazon.com to buy the book. It can at this time also be purchased off the Barnes & Noble site.
Okay.
And there's lots of links going up here and there that I'm trying to keep track of, but as I'm somewhat new to this whole web publishing thing, I'm a little bit behind the curve. But
it's a great website.
If you go to alanrolnick.com, you can find the book, you can find info on the book, and stuff like that there.
Wonderful. Well, you know, congratulations. This is a fantastic first novel, Alan. And please send a congratulations to your wife, Sharon, as well on the great recognition she's getting on this recent film. So I know that you are in the process of writing a second book at this point, and, you know, I just want to finish up the interview here by giving you the opportunity to share your final thoughts, and you can mention the second book if you like or whatever you want to share with listeners today.
Well,
keeping it kind of short.
Of course. It is going to be short because I'm really flabbergasted and humbled by the response that the book has received, because there was really no way to predict that. And as in fact is discussed in the book, nobody in the business of purchasing art to sell it screenplay or rock band or a movie, nobody ever gets fired for passing act. Everybody passed on the beat. Nobody got fired in any A&R department for that. What you get fired for is taking in the project that the company loses money on. And in fact, Walter and Benji have a scene earlier in early in Landmark Status at the Century Club where Benji's trying to explain to Walter what a stupid deal he made with Mammoth Development Company by using that very example, Moby Grape versus the Beatles. You get fired for signing Moby Grape. You don't get fired for passing those. Nobody got fired. Nobody gets fired for passing on an author's manuscript.
That's true.
You know, and there's no way to predict what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But I got tired of trying to persuade people that there was an audience out there for a farcical novel that raised questions about the American creed and had a bunch of middle-aged connivers running around in it, some of them complaining that they needed reading glasses, others in denial about it. So that I sit here now just really, really excited that the book has been accepted in some quarters, and that it's making people laugh, it's making people think. I adverted earlier to the fact that the book I'm working on now has some of the same characters in it, including Benji's father Bernard, who is he's really fun. I really like Bernard.
Yeah,
great character. The adventure in the new book is going to be a little bit different. It's going to involve some of the same kind of activity. Hopefully it'll be thought-provoking and funny. I can say for sure that it's got somewhat of an expanded worldview because we've moved up from Dade to Broward County. And I think I'm ready to take on the whole Tri-County area, including Palm Beach County, too. So.
Oh, okay.
So we're expanding our horizons, getting much more ambitious.
And, moving up the coast.
Yeah, just trying to move up the coast a little bit and broaden our horizons.
Wonderful. Well, I know readers are definitely going to be looking for the second book. When are you thinking this might be finished and published and on shelves?
Well, I want to make sure that it isn't hurried out.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, within a year.
Yes. Well, that's quick.
We're hoping to have that thing ready to go.
Great. Well, Beth,
but I don't know.
You...
The characters may complain.
Yeah.
Then sometimes they do stuff you don't expect them to do.
That's true. They may have more to say than what you think at
than
this
I
point.
Than I planned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. It does happen. You wind them up and let them go, and then they start complaining that they don't have lines.
Well, best to you, Alan. It's been great talking with you, and once again, congratulations, and I hope to talk with you again next year when book two is out.
Thank you so much, Juanita.
All right. Well, there you go, listeners. What a great, great interview, the book Landmark Status, and I've been talking with author Alan Rolnick. You can go to alanrolnick.com for more information about this great, great author and his new novel. So, once again, thank you so much for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.